The views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. would not take part in a counteroffensive against Iran, according to a White House official. Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam.
Netanyahu reconvened a war cabinet meeting in Tel Aviv to discuss a response to the drone and missile attack. War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz warned that Israel would, quote, exact the price from Iran in a fashion and timing that is right for us. Iran's armed forces chief said the operation was considered successful and, quote, deemed the matter concluded. But Iran warned Israel and the U.S. that a retaliation to its overnight attack would elicit a far bigger response.
That's Reuters' Chris Dignam reporting. Meanwhile, Biden and the White House are confirming with allies over the Iranian attack.
The meeting of G7 leaders was to work out a coordinated diplomatic response to Iran's first ever direct attack into Israel. A statement was released condemning the barrage of drones and missiles. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby on NBC's Meet the Press.
It's just an extraordinary example of military superiority that Israel demonstrated.
Israeli authorities say 99% of the weapons were shot down, but the intensity of the attack is raising concern. I'm Jackie Quinn.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he will try to advance wartime aid for Israel this week. Johnson is attempting the difficult task of winning House approval for a national security package that also includes funding for Ukrainian allies in Asia. The Republican speaker was already under immense political pressure from his fellow GOP lawmakers. He has sat for 2 months on a $95 billion supplemental package that would send support to U.S. allies. This is VOA News. More civilians have died across Ukraine as analysts warn that delays in U.S. aid would see Kyiv struggle to fight off Russian offensives. At least 6 people were killed by drone strikes and shelling across Ukraine. That news came as a Washington-based think tank warned that delays in Western military assistance would increasingly hamper Ukraine's ability to fight back Russian advances. The Institute for the Study of War said Sunday that the Russian military command likely thinks that Ukrainian forces will be unable to defend against current and future Russian offensive operations due to the lack of U.S. assistance. Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz has arrived in China on a visit marked by trade tensions and Ukraine conflict. AP correspondent Karen Shamas.
German companies such as BMW and Volkswagen are highly reliant on the Chinese market, but Beijing's support for Russia creates frictions with the West. The Chancellor's visit also comes as German companies argue that they face unfair market barriers in China. This has led the German government to push for a policy of de-risking to reduce reliance on the Chinese market and suppliers. Nevertheless, China remained Germany's top trading partner for the 8th straight year in 2023, with $271 billion in goods and services. After a visit in Shanghai, Scholz will end his 3-day visit in Beijing, where he will meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping. I'm Karen Shamas.
Donald Trump goes to court on Monday as the first U.S. ex-president ever to be criminally prosecuted. VOA's Joe Ramsey has a preview.
The scandal-plagued 77-year-old Trump is accused of falsifying business records in a scheme to cover up an alleged sexual encounter with adult film actress Stormy Daniels to shield his 2016 election campaign from adverse publicity. The so-called hush money affair is only one of 4 criminal cases hanging over Trump, and some legal observers suggest it is the least serious. But the real prospect of Trump becoming a convicted felon and potentially facing jail time throws an unprecedented wild card into an already unpredictable election. The right-wing populist is running on dark vows of vengeance against Democratic President Joe Biden, who beat him in 2020. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Pope Francis has sided with a group of Peruvian villagers who have complained that companies linked to a powerful South American church group have tried to evict them from their land using lawsuits and obscure land titling schemes. In a video Saturday recorded at his Vatican residence, the Pope sent a message of support to members of the San Juan Bautista de Catacos farmers community in northern Peru. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bati in Washington. Today is Monday, April 15th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Today, Monday, marks the first anniversary of Sudan's conflict, for which many analysts foresee no end.
We're talking now about around 25 million people in need of humanitarian aid, so more than half of the population. Hunger is the number one issue in Sudan now.
We also speak with the president of the Sudanese American Physicians Association. A protest in Niger calls for the departure of U.S. and all other foreign military forces. The home of the Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives is engulfed in fire. Campaigns for Togo's April 29 legislative election began over the weekend amid opposition protests.
Now that we are going for legislative elections, I think this is the opportunity for all the stakeholders, including the opposition, to explain to the population why they are opposed to the process of revising the constitution.
And the U.S. helped Israel repel an Iranian drone and missile attack. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It has been a year today, April 15th, since war broke out in Sudan. Many analysts foresee no end to the conflict and say the longer it drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorist groups. VOA spoke via video to a volunteer at one of the last functioning hospitals in Omdurman. Henry Wilkins reports.
From day one of Sudan's war a year ago, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has ravaged Sudan's twin cities of Khartoum, its capital, and Omdurman, its largest. Millions have fled the metropolitan area because of the fighting. Some have stayed, however, either because they don't have the means to leave, or in a few cases, because they chose to stay and help. Momin Ahmed Abbas volunteers at one of Omdurman's last functional hospitals and refuses to flee the city.
I cannot abandon them, especially when they rely on my support. Thus, I remain to ensure that injured individuals have access to essentials like food, shelter, and medical care. Leaving would only exacerbate the situation for those in need.
He says the situation is desperate at the hospital, which lacks medical supplies and security, and is vulnerable to frequent airstrikes and fighting. Humanitarian groups and international journalists have found entry into Khartoum and many other parts of Sudan all but impossible. And as a result, the world's awareness of the country's troubles has diminished. Commentators and diplomats often refer to Sudan's conflict as the world's forgotten war, despite as many as 16,000 people estimated to have died because of the conflict and 8.6 million forcibly displaced. Analysts say pressure from the international community is needed to bring the warring sides to the negotiating table. But one doesn't see that happening anytime soon.
Sadly, I don't see this conflict as particularly ripe for any kind of resolution right now. Both sides think either that they can win or they have to win. And as long as they continue to be sustained by external actors, providing them weapons and intelligence, then they're going to continue this fight.
A recent U.S. intelligence report says the longer the war drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorists. One analyst who spoke to VOA echoed this view.
You got young people and they have all the fuel. They have the anger, they have the ethnic division, and then they have whatever the narrative about there is a just war happening somewhere.
Leaders of both warring sides are wildly unpopular among most Sudanese. Neither has ever been democratically elected. Yet Sudanese civilians are the ones bearing the brunt of the ongoing fighting. Abbas says Sudan needs external help and intervention.
We desperately need international support to address the crisis in Sudan. Awareness must be raised about the ongoing suffering and devastation.
Yet, after 1 year of fighting in Sudan, it seems clear that no substantial help is on its way. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
It has been a year since fighting broke out between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces in their long-running battle for control of the country. Dr. Yasser Al-Amin is a medical oncologist and president of the Sudanese American Physicians Association. He tells viewers Caravan Dam that in recent months, the fighting has only intensified and that millions of people are suffering.
We're talking now about around 25 million people in need of humanitarian aid, so more than half of the population. Hunger is the number one issue in Sudan now. When it comes to healthcare services, where our organization is operating mostly, 60% to 70% of hospitals are non-operational. In some refugee camps, according to MSF Doctors Without Borders, a child dies every 2 hours. According to the IRC, now Sudan is the number one humanitarian crisis in the world. So sadly, the situation is getting worse by the day.
We heard a few months ago that many of the hospitals and health clinics have closed down because it was just too dangerous. They didn't have enough supplies. Is that the same now, today?
Yes, exactly. Indeed, around 60 to 70% of hospitals are closed. One of the hospitals that we at SAPA were running in Medini Al Jazeera had to shut down in mid of December 2023, a hospital that was providing care to 5,000 patients per month. It has been closed since then. We weren't able to reopen it due to security reasons, and that's the case across the board. Again, almost two-thirds of hospitals in the country are not operational. You have maternity services not being fully provided. Vaccination to kids is not being fully provided. So the health situation in particular, due to lack of funding and due to lack of safe access, is really terrible.
What is your advice, I guess, for people who are still facing injuries and hardship and need to get to a hospital? What should they do if they're stuck in various parts of Sudan because of the fighting?
Well, you know, sadly, at an individual level, there is little that you can do. I remember in the earlier days of the war, in social media platforms like WhatsApp, Sudanese communities were exchanging tips on how a woman can have a safe delivery at home. So it was that bad due to lack of access to hospitals. Our call here is to the warring parties to ensure that there is safe passage of aid. And our call to the international community is to increase its aid to Sudan. The numbers are very clear. The UN has announced that only 5% of its plan for 2024 is funded. Only 5%. Just let this number sink in. 5% of what the UN needs to be able to provide oxygen, medicine, vaccinations, food. The UN has only 5% of that budget.
Dr. Yasser Al-Amin is the president of the Sudanese American Physicians Association. He was speaking from Houston, Texas, with my colleague Carol Van Dam. A Togolese government official says the April 29 legislative and regional elections present an opportunity for the Togolese people to deliver a verdict on the new constitutional reform approved recently by Parliament. The new constitution gives the election of the president to Parliament. Campaigning for the April 29 vote began over the weekend. Gilbert Bawara is the Togolese Minister for Civil Service, Labor, and Social Dialogue. He tells me the constitutional revision is necessary, especially given what he calls the chaos that is taking place in the West Africa sub-region.
The campaign is proceeding very smoothly, and we hope that it will continue on this note.
Are opposition candidates also participating in this campaign?
Yes, definitely. All the major political parties, including those of the opposition, all of them are campaigning.
Gilbert, as you know, the opposition has been leading protests, particularly against this new constitution. Now, what can you tell us about this constitution?
When you have a look into the chaos and the difficulties that are undergoing in other countries in the region, either in the Sahel and West Africa, I think we have to make sure that we anticipate and put in place the political reforms that will help us to maintain peace, security, stability, to make sure that Togolese people in all their components are able to mobilize and participate to the development. So the fact that the majority has taken its responsibility to undertake the review and the reform of the constitution, this is completely normal. The fact that there are some debates and opposition, or some of the leaders of the opposition, are protesting. This is also democratic. So now that we are going for legislative election, I think this is the opportunity for all the stakeholders, including the opposition, to explain to the population why they are opposed to the process of revising the constitution. And we will take also the opportunity to explain to the Togolese the benefit and the advantage for the country, and then Togolese will decide.
But Gilbert, as you know, the opposition is protesting because the constitution, as the draft suggests, some would say is undemocratic, because they say only members of the parliament can determine the presidency.
When the people of South Africa elected the members of the parliament, and the members of the parliament in their turn elected the president, do you think it is democratic or non-democratic? In other countries, when the population are called to vote, and on the basis of the result, the councillor, like in Germany, the prime minister in England, are appointed by the members of the parliament. Do you think this is democratic or not democratic? I think we can have that debate with the Togolese, and at the end, when the Togolese will decide, so we have to respect it. If the Togolese decided that they will want to give the majority to the opposition, then the opposition have the possibility to take other initiatives, or they will have the opportunity to make sure that the president will be coming from the opposition. So all this for me is completely democratic, and what is important is that all the political parties have now the opportunity to go to the population to explain their position and their opinion. And the result of the legislative election will show us what is really the position of the population of Togo.
Gilbert Bawara is the Togolese Minister for Civil Service, Labor and Social Dialogue. He is also a prominent member of the ruling Union for the Republic Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lomé. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 15. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. There was an anti-U.S. protest in Niger over the weekend calling for the departure of U.S. and all foreign military forces. U.S. forces have been helping Niger's government combat Islamic militants in the Sahel. VOA's French to Africa Service reporter Abdul Razak in Niamey tells me the protest was called by civil society organizations sympathetic to the military government, and that it comes as Russian troops arrived in the country last week to provide security for the junta.
The demonstration took place in Niamey on Saturday. Several hundred people responded to this call and march in the streets of the capital of Niger, Niamey. Among the demonstrators, members of the junta were seen, and the objective of the demonstration is to support the junta and also demand the departure of American soldiers from Nigerian territory. During the demonstration, slogans hostile to these American soldiers were chanted. The demonstration supports the decision of the authority in place in Niamey to denounce almost a month ago the agreement relating to the status of United States military personnel which links Niger and the United States. The junta justified this decision by the illegal nature of the presence of American soldiers on Nigerian territory, but also by the fact that it does not meet the aspirations and interests of Nigerian people. This Saturday demonstration comes 3 days after the landing in Niamey of Russian instructors who delivered the first military equipment as part of cooperation with Moscow. Images of this material were shown on Nigerian national television, Africa Corps, the Russian military corps, which replaced the Wagner group, has asserted its presence in Niger. Two of its members, Houdit, were shown on national television. One declares that he is present to develop military cooperation between Niger and Russia and to train the Nigerian army and help it use the military equipment that has just arrived.
VOA's French to Africa service reporter Abdul Razak was speaking with us from the Niger capital, Niamey. The home of the Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives in the capital, Monrovia, was gutted by fire last evening. Speaker J. Fonati Kofa says he and his family escaped unharmed. However, he says the entire house was destroyed. He tells me the National Fire Service was notified but arrived after his home had been engulfed. One local media report citing witnesses said the fire department encountered some difficulties gaining access to the property.
Apparently, there was some electrical appliance in the theater of our home that maybe had a malfunction and developed a fire, because it's an area of the house where we are rarely visit, except when the children are at home. I haven't been in that area for about 2 or 3 months. We did not notice it was a fire until they were full blown, and so we evacuated the house immediately. We thank our neighbors who were very, very helpful in making sure we evacuated safely.
That's very good that you have evacuated, but how bad is it?
It's very bad. I think the entire house is gutted. Nothing there is salvageable.
Did the fire department come around to at least help?
Yes, unfortunately, they came, but unfortunately, about 3 hours, and at that point, there was not much help. I think they are now in the process of dosing the flames, the remaining flames, and we'll get to see the damage tomorrow.
Speaker, we're very sorry.
Yeah, thank you.
Is this the only residence that you have in Monrovia?
No, I have a residence in Broadville, and that's probably going to be my home for now until we renovate.
Thank you so much, Speaker. It's so nice to talk with you.
All right, thank you so much.
Jeff Onati Kofa is the Speaker of the Liberia House of Representatives. He spoke with me from the capital, Monrovia. The White House calls it an incredible military achievement by Israel, the United States, and other partners in repelling more than 300 drones and missiles launched by Iran towards Israel. VOA's Araj Arabasadi has more.
A barrage of objects streaks across the night sky from Bethlehem in the West Bank amid drone and missile attacks from Iran toward Israel. The Israeli military says the Islamic Republic launched more than 300 such projectiles, but said it, with help from the U.S. and partners, shot down 99% of them. Iran has warned it would hit Israel in retaliation after a suspected Israeli airstrike earlier this month destroyed the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, killing 12, including 2 top Iranian generals. U.S. President Joe Biden issued a statement on X, formerly Twitter, confirming U.S. involvement in the operation and reaffirming what he calls America's ironclad commitment to the security of Israel. His presumptive opponent for the 2024 presidential election, former President Donald Trump, took to his social media platform to say without evidence the attack would never have happened if he were president. By all accounts, the damage inside Israel was minimal, something Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian describes as deliberate. At a recent news conference in Tehran, he said Iran communicated the attack to the White House and regional neighbors in what he called a legitimate defense and punishment of the Israeli regime. But by Sunday morning, Biden administration officials took a victory lap for the coordinated defense against Iran's barrage. White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby on ABC's This Week, as carried on X, formerly Twitter.
Truly a successful night, and due to a lot of skill, a lot of professionalism, and a lot of coordination across the board. Israel succeeded in defending itself, and the United States certainly made good our commitment to help them do that.
U.S. lawmakers supporting Israel's self-defense rejected the idea of a broadening regional conflict that would include American soldiers. Republican Representative Mike Turner speaking Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, as provided by X, formerly Twitter.
I don't think at this point that the United States should be engaged in a military action directly at Iran. But I do believe that if this administration fails to step up to the plate and understand that we have an escalating conflict and make it clear to Iran that there are red lines and that the United States will defend Israel and will not allow Iran to become a weapon state, that we will be in a broader conflict and we will have less options.
Video from Iran after the attack shows people celebrating in Tehran, waving both Iranian and Palestinian flags as their country's leadership vows ongoing solidarity with Palestinians amid the ongoing Israel-Hamas conflict. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin Daybreak Africa Sports with football. The president of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Dr. Patrice Motsepe, has concluded his visits to Angola, Equatorial Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Sao Tome and Principe, and Morocco. During Dr. Patrice Motsepe's visit, he met with the presidents of all the countries he visited. The CAF president said the meetings he had with the heads of state and their ministers of sports, as well as the private sector and businesses of the countries he visited, has confirmed the global competitiveness of football in these football-loving countries.
My visit of the last few days visiting mainly the Portuguese-speaking countries in CAF, and I also went to, I also had a meeting with the head of state of Guinea Equatorial, because they are Spanish-speaking, and the aim was to make sure that the Portuguese-speaking countries in Africa, including the one Spanish-speaking country, Guinea Equatorial, that their views and their interests are significantly highlighted and promoted within Africa.
In the meantime, Angola Minister of Youth and Sport, Rio Falcao, has ruled out the possibility of Angola hosting the Africa Cup of Nations in 2029. He stated that the country's current priority is a celebration of 50 years of national independence scheduled for 2025. The sport minister spoke shortly after the president of CAF, Patrice Motsepe, visited President Yao Lourenço in the state house. The sport minister, however, said everything will be done to ensure Angola qualify for the next Africa Cup of Nations and, if possible, reach the finals. In table tennis news, the Togo Table Tennis Federation is hosting the tour tagged the Lomé Ping Pong across seven local communities. The tour aims to engage fans by inviting them to play while also raising awareness about the upcoming 2024 West Africa Table Tennis Regionals that gathers the best players from the West Africa sub-region. Elsewhere in Uganda, four national table tennis players have qualified for the Africa Cup, which is set to take place from May 10th to the 16th in Kigali, Rwanda. This comes after the one-day qualification tournament played at the Lugogo Indoor Stadium at the weekend. Robert Jagawe, president of the Uganda Table Tennis Federation, says the Kigali tournament is an opportunity for players to take advantage of the tournament to qualify for the Olympics.
We've already told the players and the coaches and the club that the last chance is in Kigali, Rwanda. That's our very last chance. Then, beyond that, we shall have to keep fighting in these other many tournaments where someone can pick up points. But also we have the regional senior championship coming up.
And finally, in athletics, elite athletes from all over the world are in Boston to take part in the 128th Boston Marathon scheduled for Monday, April the 15th. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, April 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Mbati in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.